woke up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Oh. Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
Oh, it's, it's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
Lone Wolf Base, Stacks and Jacks, I'm Tom Owl, Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up a buck, Chuck. NASDAQ Futures down 26. We still try and come back from the pretty lousy day on Tuesday. We'll see if we can accomplish that today or not. We have Professor Lou.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm doing all right, how are you?
Oh, it's just peachy out here. Got a little break in our heat wave. We had some rain last night, so always a positive.
Well, you guys like your rain. We're supposed to get some rain tonight, I think, here. It's been very nice. It's been very non-humid and nice weather. Pretty nice stretch the last 4 or 5 days. Supposed to get chilly this weekend, but it's always nice.
Good. I was listening to one of the shows, and Greg was talking about some downpour going on, and I just flashed back to a number of mornings, it seemed, when I would walk from the train station at Adams and just get soaked coming into the show. So I'm glad I don't do that anymore.
You were, wait a minute, we loved you here.
I would have an opportunity to partake of the Stocks and Jocks World Headquarters Breakfast Buffet and all that, but you know it never really seemed to make up for wet pants and socks walking back to my office.
To be perfectly blunt, you want to stretch as you would come in. I think it was Tuesday your day? I think it was.
I think Tuesday was originally, yeah.
There was a stretch when we had like virtually no rain except something like 7 out of 8 Tuesday mornings it was raining. You were a jinx on Tuesday morning. You did it yourself.
I definitely was. I was describing to somebody here getting caught walking to the train, and I had about not quite a mile walk to the train from my house, maybe I don't know, 0.8 mile, and getting caught in a downpour at like, you know, some awful hour, and I'm sure it was because I was coming to the show, but you know, having water squishing out of my shoes it was so wet where I was going, and you know, and I had an umbrella and it didn't matter.
No, unless you have a big old golf umbrella or something designed for like 3 people under it, you're kind of screwed if it's coming from the side.
Yeah,
it happened once in New York when I was out there in a SIBO thing, and I'm wearing my suit, walking down the street, and all of a sudden, you're between these big buildings. There's nowhere to go. There's not an awning. Like, this is just great.
Well, it was so bad. In fact, I think, if I remember, I wasn't coming to the radio show. I was coming in early for work for something because it was pitch black when I was coming in, and I got to the office, and I walked around the office barefoot for about an hour while I tried fruitlessly to dry my socks.
Well. Well, you know, that Sox game I went to last Tuesday, in today's world, I have not seen anything like that in 25 years. I mean, usually these guys have, especially these ballparks, have the radar and they've got all this stuff going. I showed up there like at 5 to 6, maybe one cloud in the sky, and they're talking about some, you know, some thunderstorm out in Huntley or someplace.
Oh, maybe, I saw. Yeah, I maybe saw coming this, of that storm.
But you know, the guys are out there warming up in the sun and everything, and you know, it kind of was so hot. We were in the skybox. We had the windows closed, so you couldn't really, you know, you're staring out there, but everybody's pretty much mingling. And all of a sudden, you see these guys run out on the field. Within four pitches, it is pouring. Even the Sox after the game said, we've never been surprised like that. It started pouring, and by the time the guys got the tarp on there, and they're pretty fast, infield must have had 20 puddles. I don't know how they could have played afterward. It just came down so hard, so fast. I mean, how in today's day and age, how do you not see that? It just opened up. I mean, they've never been surprised like that by a storm in 10 years.
Yeah, I recall when I worked at 77 West Wacker, we were up on the 50th floor of that building, and hearing, you know, people in the office, this was like at 5:30 or something, so rush hour, 6 o'clock rush hour was over, and people coming in and saying, hey, you know, you need to get to take a look out the west side of the building because they're clearing the streets. And we go over to the west side, and it's just pitch black, a line of clouds, and it's moving. You can see it just racing across the western suburbs. And I look down the street, and the cops are literally forcing people off the streets into doorways. And this thing, when the storm hit, you know, it the first wave of it literally buffeted the building. You could sort of feel the building kind of jolt as the squall line hit. That's probably the worst I've seen in Chicago. It was just one of those things where you sort of, because we were so high up, you could just sort of watch this dreadful, you know, black cloud racing into the city.
Those buildings move pretty good. I think the Hancock can move 9 feet, right, at the top?
It's some incredible number like that. Yeah. But I mean, you felt the storm just hit the building and this boom and just a bump, and you're just thinking.
I actually think, Luna,
that's pretty good.
You wine snob dudes like you and Greg, I think you're not supposed to store your wine above like the 70th floor at the Hancock or something, because it moves too much.
Oh, I
would not be a snob.
I wouldn't know anything about storing wine, drinking it, or anything else about it.
Well, there you go. It's a little piece. Hey, a lot of kind of crummy news here in Chicago. We'll talk about the market here in a second, but the this shooting in Forest Park, as everybody here, pretty you know, I don't know what the term would be.
Oh, with the four people killed on the subway, sleeping.
Yeah,
and but they've got video. They have the guy, right?
Yeah. Well, I sent that thing to you yesterday, and last night I just happened to be in conversation with a gentleman who has done, you know, criminal work for I'm going to say 50 years somewhere knows in that range, and I said to him, the quick statement on this guy who got picked up. Now here's, you know, whatever, he's your 30-year-old whatever suspect in the the alleged shooter has various charges in Cook County dating back to 2012 under various names. That's 12 years ago. The guy's 30, including Rianni Davis and James McDavis. I guess he was Irish for a weekend. His previous charges include battery charge in 2014, which he pleaded guilty under the name of James McDavis. Court records show he was given a fine and 2 years court supervision. 2019, under the name of Rianni Davis, he faced charges for unlawful use of a weapon and having an open container, both of which were later dropped. He also faced a disorderly conduct charge. 2020, was found guilty after it was being discovered in Bloomingdale's after it was being looted. So he helped himself to the riots. 2021, court records show he faced an additional weapon charge, which was later dropped. So I said to my friend, who happens to be named Bill, and these are, you know, he defends people all the time, I said, you know, what is the deal? How many people like this are out there that you could probably make the statement, I don't know the man, have virtually zero education, zero morals, never probably worked a day in their life. I mean, how many of these guys are wandering around? He goes, all kinds of them, all kinds of them. He goes, the total family breakdown, the politicians being as crooked as they can be. If there is money going that way, it never gets to the people. He says it's just in and out. I said, well, how do you get all these things discharged. He goes, the police don't show up. Yeah, that's how, you know, I get a lot of people off because the police don't show up. I mean, he says, but it is a problem. He goes, I said, what's the solution? He goes, Tom, I've been doing this 50 years. I have no idea. I used to think that I could come up with a solution back when I was younger, which he's up there now. He goes, I can't think of a solution. How we would all start at once to try and fix this stuff. He goes, it's just, there's all kinds of these people running around. None of them have ever had a father at home. Nobody's ever had a family. There's no discipline, no anything. It's just...
Well, yeah, and so this was done in an act of malice, I assume?
I don't receive... Nobody has any idea. People were asleep.
Yeah, were these folks homeless, or...
Well, they had an interview with the one guy's father. The one guy's a vet. And he's from... I think I remember. He's from Maryland or someplace. He got out of the Navy last year. Somehow could not get himself back in society, whether he's on some drugs. And father said he's a good kid. He had a decent record in the Navy. And now he just kind of hit the streets. And here he is dead on a train, sleeping at 5 in the morning.
Unbelievable. Well, no, it's not unbelievable. It's perfectly believable. I mean, one of the issues we gotta deal with is, and you know, this guy kills four people. You got the 14-year-old in Georgia that killed four, wounded nine yesterday.
Yep.
And that kid, I mean, that kid had been on the FBI's radar as a 13-year-old.
How can you even do that?
and then, well, he was on the radar, and so apparently, you know, I look at this lunatic in Forest Park, and I say, okay, this is one kind of problem. This is a guy who is a career criminal, who is just decides, you know, what the heck, I'm just going to shoot people, and I'm going to do it in a way that in a place where I know I'm going to get caught. Although he had a mask on, I guess. I know I'm going to get videoed, and I'm going to do it anyway. So that's one issue. The 14-year-old killing four and wounding nine others, shooting 13 people at school, when he's been on the FBI's radar as a potential school shooter, is another. And I know and they apparently had some assurance.
Well, how do you get on the radar at 13 as a school shooter?
Well, you make threats online that you're going to go in and shoot a bunch of your classmates, which apparently he did something like that. That's another issue, but we seem to be unable to deal with these, you know, unwilling to deal with these problems. And I mean, part of it is just stupidity. I mean, there's a lack of will on the part of our political leadership to enforce laws that we have against the people that we should know are dangerous. And then, you know, that gets multiply that by, you know, by 10 or 20,000, and you've got a bunch of dangerous people wandering around who have ready access to guns, and it doesn't matter what laws you pass in response to the problem, because you're not enforcing the laws that you have right now that will deal with it. This guy, you know, your shooter in Forest Park should have been locked up somewhere. And they should have pushed when he, you know, was arrested for having a handgun or whatever. This kid in Georgia at 13, you know, we think he might be a school shooter. And the dad says, "Well, I got all my guns locked up. You know, he doesn't have access to the firearms." You know, my response to that is, "I don't care. You think he's got to get a gun from home? You don't think he can wander down? He can wander down into Atlanta, 90 minutes away, and figure out? I mean, if he's focused on this, you know, if you come up on the radar of the FBI at 13 as a potential violent person, then you probably shouldn't be in the school with the rest of your classmates.
Well, what's the had, what is the crime there?
Tom, they and they had a warning that morning that, that there was going to be a shooting at the school.
How do you what do you charge him with? I mean, how do you get him out of society at 13?
You don't have to charge him. You simply say this kid's profile means he's a risk to other students. We are expelling him. We're not going to educate him.
To where?
You got, pardon me?
To where?
The state doesn't have a responsibility to do something with him. The parents, you just basically tell the parents you're going to have to make alternative arrangements. But you don't even.
But that's not a fix for him.
Well, the fix for the kid is removal, so that he doesn't do something that's going to end him up in an adult prison, which is what's going to happen. They're going to charge him as an adult in an adult prison for the rest of his life. You figure out that the parents are responsible to figure out some other mechanism of dealing with him. But the idea that you would have a kid on the radar of the FBI at 13, you get a phone call that morning at the school saying, hey, we think there's likely to be a shooting today.
Where did that come from? Is there any idea?
I don't know. I my understanding was it was anonymous. But, I mean, at some point, doesn't somebody look around and go, you know what? We have a guy here who's been flagged already. Maybe we ought to go talk to him. I mean, it's just there's just a lack of willingness to take these people on. And,
Lou, where did we lose this sense of common sense? I'm not saying we always had it, but I mean, it seems like no matter how many, the more police you have, the less they do. It's weird.
A huge element of our law enforcement issues are race based, and I mean you had a significant percentage of the elites, the so-called elites in 2020, screaming defund the police. You know, Minneapolis is still fighting that. And you know, the idea that you could somehow say to yourselves, well, you know, we're just going to shut down police law enforcement because we've got a problem with an imaginary problem of unarmed black people being shot, you know, willy-nilly by racist cops, and a totally incorrect political narrative. But you had a bunch of people running around screaming, let's defund the police.
Well, you did, but you also have departments.
And everybody... I'm just saying, if you've got that kind of mentality in your leadership elites, this is not a surprise that this kind of problem manifests itself.
Well, why does it seem like every level, I'm going to get a break here, of whatever the bureaucracy is, whatever the level is, it seems like the incompetence is dramatic.
Tom... The Denver police, because it has disproportionate impact on quote unquote, you know, our new guests here in Denver, the Denver cops have stopped enforcing basic traffic laws like no registration, no license plate on your car, no vehicle safety inspection. They've stopped enforcing that because it has a disparate impact, quote unquote, on poor and
there are those of us
migrants.
That same thing is happening here, except they don't even pull over white people in Discovers that fly through red lights and stop signs. It's a total dropout with the idea you can't stop anybody. The sergeant has to sign it. It's a pain in the ass. Well, you know what? Here's my thing. I would never force anybody to be, and I know this is very unpopular, God, if I was on a regular station, if I would never force anybody to be a police, and my dad was one, my uncle was one, and I think the job is becoming increasingly more difficult because of a lot of this stuff, but I also am not going to go with the route where I can't do this, I can't do this, I can't do this. Well, you know, I'm not paying you to not do stuff. If you want to quit and you want to go do something else, I understand fully. But if you're going to show up, you don't watch people. I don't see a soul here, Lou. I don't see a soul in traffic. A guy goes down the shoulder 100 miles an hour. I never see a car. Never. And that's the state police or the city. Where is everybody?
As I said, here it is the city council of Denver said we don't want the cops enforcing these basic traffic laws, which, you know, any student of criminal policy and public policy would tell you, wait a minute, if you stop enforcing basic stuff like this, you lose the ability to enforce much more significant
laws. It's basic laziness, or hiding behind something, or not having enough support behind him. You don't see anybody. I mean, here I'd be really hard pressed. I actually did see a few months ago the guy in the state police pull a guy over on the Ryan, and this one guy walks up to this car, you know, with the windows, you can't tell who's in there or whatever. Lou, I would never ask anybody to do that. Why isn't every time there's a traffic pullover, you radio ahead and you get help in the front and the back of the car? You tell people, if you can't see in the windows, get the hell out. I mean, there's a way to do this. I mean, nobody ever helps the guy. This guy didn't have any backup. I mean, it is somehow or another, if you're going to show, you know, I hired traders for the trading floor. Yeah, but to pay you to go and be a trader, when you learn, you get a percentage on what you make. Well, I can't trade. What do you mean? You realize all the bad things that happen when you trade? You could lose money, you could have an out trade. Yeah, but I'm paying you to trade. Oh, yeah, it's way too dangerous. Okay. Trading is very difficult, but I'm not going to pay you to not do it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we are not, our elected leadership, the politically activist class that dominates in a lot of our major cities, is completely divorced from reality, as far as I can tell, with respect to what they think, you know, is going to work, or what government, you know, should be doing. And we have the same problem in Denver that you do in Chicago, just at a greatly reduced level. And we're seeing manifestations now of the kind of civil breakdown that you know is endemic when you have people who say, we're not going to enforce basic legal requirements, and you're going to end up, I mean, we've got now out here, you've probably seen the stories, we've got a significant Venezuelan gang presence out in one of our suburbs, where these guys have started running apartment buildings, you know, and enforcing, taking, collecting rent, and enforcing criminal operations within 4 or 5 blocks here in Aurora. Totally unenforced by the cops. I mean, the cops will go in there occasionally, but they are not fighting it. Now, from a historical perspective, you and I have lived in a place where something similar happened, you know, in the early 1900s, where we had large importation of immigrants from places like Italy, and they brought their gangs with them, right?
Well, they also had, the society wouldn't let them in.
Well, question whether society wouldn't let them in. These were guys doing low-end work in neighborhoods that didn't assimilate very well, and you had the criminal element move with them. And I mean, we're seeing it play out. You would have thought somebody would be looking at those historical perspectives and saying, yeah, we need to respond to this. Apparently we are incapable of doing it here in Denver.
Well, we have people with an amazing lack of foresight, for some reason, and you take, well, it was already happening long before, but take the COVID situation. All right, we're going to push people through school that, by the way, don't belong in 8th grade or 7th grade, but we're going to push them through anyway, and we're going to graduate everybody. Now, we know that all the skill set that you need even for a menial job, probably a lot of these people don't have. Okay, so I'm not talking about black or white, depending on what part of the country you're in. It's everybody's a different color, right? And so we're gonna push these guys forward. We're going to get them out of grammar school. We're going to get them out of high school. What do people expect this person to do at age 18 or 19 when there's not a whole lot of, there's not a Pullman or a U.S. Steel around that says, just show up, You'll be sweeping the factory, and then we'll train you for other stuff as time goes by. That's not happening, right? That used to happen, but as long as you were willing to show up and work hard, somebody found a job for you. That's not happening. You have to have some sort of skill set, whatever it is. And so now you pile out and you look at this drug trade. Wow, that guy, I can do that. That doesn't sound, I can do that, and I can make more money there anyway. So you end up with this, you keep pushing people with no skills somewhere, and you expect them somehow to fend for themselves. How the hell are you going to do that? They don't have a family to fall back on. It's not like the old man's running a painting company, and the kid can go paint with the old man and make some money. The old man's, he probably never met the old man, or if he did, it's once or twice. I mean, how do we, it's right in front of everybody's eyes, and it's been there for 30 years. I mean, what did Dr. J one day said some very succinctly for a long time? The least the grandmother was able to raise the kids, because the grandmother came from a generation where they, you know, you knew how to raise a family. Now the grandmothers are dead. I mean, this has not been a phenomenon. It's been a week or two ago. Yet people continue to make money in all these programs that supposedly are going to help out. And I think they make things worse in some ways. I mean, if ever we needed technical schools, it would be now, rather than 40 or 50 years ago. And we have any? I mean, and yet there's money being spent all over the place.
Tom, we've had this discussion before, but the most effective education, anti-crime education operation in Chicago, and in a number of other places, but I'm familiar with the one in Chicago, was the J. Rotzi schools that you guys had. Hey, they pulled kids in. They gave them a sense of purpose. They gave them a focus. They gave them order, which is, I think, the most important thing you can provide for
kids.
Any
want
teenager.
Order. People want order. Hey, I got a real quick question. We're going to break. What is the relationship after watching the Irish play Texas A&M? Texas A&M, I mean, Notre Dame had a ROTC program. It seems like A&M's...
Notre Dame's got a fantastic ROTC program.
But it seems like A&M is way beyond that. Are they almost like a military school there?
They have a section there called... Their ROTC program is organized into a corps. And I don't know how many thousand people they have in it. But the Texas A&M Corps of Cadets, and it is a military... sort of a quasi-military academy within Texas A&M.
It's
itself.
Almost like a small VMI or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's a private. You know, it's an ROTC program, but it's a military. It's organized in military. I don't know how often they have to wear their uniforms to class. I'm not sure it's every day, but the Corps of Cadets at Texas A&M is a big deal. And
are they all Army? They all were wearing tan.
The Corps of Cadets wears its own uniforms, but I don't. They're different branches of the services. They're not all Army.
Well, so they have all the branches there. Is that just one?
Yeah.
What about VMI? Is it just one? I mean, you're just going to a military school, or what are you doing?
VMI is a ROTC. You know, the kids commissioned there out of ROTC, but that they all wear the same uniforms.
That's where George Marshall went, right?
Right. Right, private military academy.
But they have, isn't...
Like VMI, the Citadel, yeah.
But don't they have the guy who runs the place? Isn't he usually a retired or not even retired? It's a big post to get once you're out of the Army, right? If you're a general, all of a sudden you're chairman of Citadel. It's a big deal.
It is a retired... Both Citadel and VMI have traditionally been run by retired general officers.
And it's a big job. It's a big...
Oh, it's huge. I mean, the Citadel... I don't know if this is still the case, but you know, if you wanted to be something in South Carolina politics or business, the way to punch your ticket was to go to the Citadel.
Really?
Virginia was something similar, although not quite, because once the collar counties around Washington, D.C. started springing up and generating the kind of financial influence that they do, the influence of the more traditional places like UVA and Bill and Mary and VMI declined. But in South Carolina, Citadel grads are huge in running the state, less so in Virginia. But still, it's a very tight group. You know, they had a very exclusive program, and it was a very tight group of people in that graduate community.
Is every single person who graduates from all those places have to go serve 2 years, or can you go there as a regular student?
No. If you went, you could go there pay your own way, and not get commissioned. You don't have to be commissioned or even go into the service.
All right, let's go for a quick break here, Lou, and we'll come back. I mean, some of this cost of all the security and stuff, I mean, every Wednesday when I pick Andrew up, I go by DePaul. There's six people standing out there at 5:15 in the morning. I don't think they're armed. They're just standing there. Who pays for all this? I mean, and yet, I don't know how effective they'd be if somebody went in there and started shooting. S&P futures down up 215, as if he was down 19. We're still kind of reeling from this drop in NVIDIA the other day, and it's up 12 cents today, but you know, it's down 20-some bucks, and we're talking about a stock that has 24 billion shares outstanding, so that's going to leave a mark. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jacks. Hello, this is Tom Harrell, the Chief. Confused about investing these days? I suspect you are not alone. Investing was never easy, although at times it may have seemed so. I think one reason behind the current concern, although maybe not explained as such, is how the fluctuation in the American dollar and the associated politics is affecting your investments and your wealth. It may not be enough to make some money in your investments. You may need now to make enough to exceed the amount that your leadership is depreciating the value of the dollars you've worked your whole life to accumulate. That same leadership has seen fit to maneuver risk-free interest rates to near zero. Providing positive risk-averse returns in a zero-interest and declining real wealth environment is by far the toughest assignment I've ever had in my years as a money manager. I'm sure that a lot of you have heard that one way to possibly deal with this problem is to invest in so-called hard currencies like silver and gold, the idea being that they will retain their relative value in the face of devaluation of paper currencies like the dollar. To be honest, I have never been a gold bug. I've always had faith that having enough dollars and a good investment strategy was good enough. Now I'm not so sure. But I do know that if I did invest in gold or silver, I'd want to do it in the same manner as we do with PTI for investments in the market, with defined risk. If you feel the need to invest in gold or silver, we can do it using the same strategies that we use for our protected index program. No matter what you invest in, we feel that you need to know and control your risk. Find us at PTISecurities.com. That's PTISecurities.com.
Stocks, jocks,
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Here, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board, and Greg, who never likes to agree with me, but I'm going to say he might on this one. If you were to have a big move, especially the downside like we had on Tuesday, and you were to write a little bit of a blurb and say what the next day was probably going to be like, now probably is a slippery word, you would say, totally non-directional, run up for a little bit, run down for a little bit, all day long, looking like we're going to recover, then not, then looking like it's going further down, then not. I would say that would be your almost normal directionless day after a big move day, and yesterday was exactly like that, wasn't it, Greg?
It's so like every day.
Well, not every day, but I'm saying it. There were how many times yesterday did you think, uh-oh, here we go, we got down again, or, uh-oh, looks like we're going to rally, and probably 10 times, and we didn't do either, right?
I was eating lunch. I didn't care.
All day? Well, this one must have been a good lunch.
Oh, yeah.
Over in Asia, we've got Nikkei down again, another 390. It's over 1%, 36,657. Hang Seng down 13, but only a little bit, 17,444. Shanghai up 4, 2,788, still under 2,800. So they're not being helped there much. In Europe, the DAX actually up a little bit, 53 at 0.3%. FTSE down 8, call that flat. Get around down 29.4%, so not much going there on over there. But you know, yesterday Dow was up 38, S&P was down 8, Nasdaq down 52, so it was not exactly a bounce. Bonds unchanged 3.77, the Bund up 1 basis point 2.23, Japan unchanged 0.88, oil down up 20 cents 69.40. I was just reading this morning, and I'll get a comment out of Lou, that for Saudi to pay all their stuff, all the people they pay over there and all their infrastructure improvements, they need $100 oil?
About 85.
Okay, yeah, but then they were talking about some other stuff. They got in 2 years, they need it to be 100. I don't think it's going to be 100.
Good luck.
Yeah, good luck with that. Brent up 34 cents, 73.04. Natural gas up 2 cents, 217. RBOB unchanged, 195, still under 2 bucks. Gold up 19 bucks, 25.45, a nice bounce. Silver up 49 cents, 29.05. The silver continues. Well, if you could go back a year here and sell it at 30 and buy it at 28.5, you'd do really, really well. Problem is you can't go back. Copper up 2 cents, 410. And we have the foreign exchange. The U.S. dollar is still 111 on the euro, right where it's been. 132 against the pound, right where it's been. Japan 143, which is Japan's strengthening a little bit here again today. Crypto. Bitcoin down $1,200, 56,658, so it's down from 61 in the last few days, so that's a big move there. We have Force Traffic Weather Sports.
Good.
No hitter!
Yeah, no hitter.
Did you watch it?
A butt kicking too. It was let's see, 12-0. Yeah, three different pitchers. Anyways, 650 here in Chicago. It is 64 right now. High of 87 today. Cloudy with showers. Possible thunderstorm. Phoenix, 90 right now. High of 114 today. Very hot. Lots of sunshine. Try to minimize outdoor activities. Traffic, inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 23 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 53 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 39 minutes. Getting worse. Dan Ryan is 19 minutes. Nope, 23 minutes. That's getting worse also from 95th. And then the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 35 minutes. Sports, kickoff tonight, 7:20. Ravens at Chiefs, that's at Arrowhead. Casey's favored by 3. White Sox beat the Orioles, that was 8-1 in Baltimore. Cubs no-hit the Pirates, like you mentioned. That was their first no-hitter in 52 years at Wrigley. Three different pitchers.
Who was the guy before? Milt Pappas.
Yeah, the 72, I want to say.
Yeah.
And Diamondbacks beat the Giants 6-4. That's all I got, guys.
Here's a piece of trivia I don't know that Lou will pick up on. Cubs did have a no-hitter not that long ago, and it was
It was 2015.
Zambrano, but it was in Milwaukee. Remember that? Lou, is this when Houston had all the rain and they couldn't play? Was it Houston? Why don't you look that up, Greg? Zambrano, no. But anyway, it was the other team's home game, so they refused to play it in Wrigley. And I ended up playing it in County Stadium, the new stadium in Miller Park in Milwaukee. And a few people drove up there, and Zambrano no hit whoever it was in Milwaukee.
I remember that circumstance. I don't remember the game specifically.
Yeah, I don't either. But I know he threw a no-hitter in Milwaukee with basically nobody watching, which is sort of weird. But, yeah, hey, Lou, this stuff starts to I don't know if you listened at all yesterday, but I'll repeat briefly. When this thing happened in Forest Park, they had you could tell he was African-American because and he comes out and interview him. And Lou, for a minute, and I'm not going to repeat everything. The guy says, I've never seen society like this. Everybody's fighting politically, yet the politicians are all crooked, it appears. Nothing's happening. Families are falling apart. People don't have a job that pays for the increases in the spending or the prices that are around. Because I've never seen people this essentially pissed off and lost in my entire lifetime. And then fast forward about 3 hours later, I'm watching these three idiots on CNBC. And all they did was talk about how great the economy's going. And what anybody who thinks that the economy isn't percolating on all cylinders basically is a moron. And I'm going, is there possibly a bigger spread between the money elites and regular people? Have you ever seen it like this? Ever? It's worse than the political elites.
I don't know if I've ever seen it. More of a perception gap than what you've just described, but that lack of context for these comments that the economy is doing fine, while we have, here in Denver we've got a monstrous homeless issue. Between the illegals who have crossed the border, who have got been dumped in here, and the drug issues that Colorado brought on itself with its idiotic legalization laws, and the appointment of an election of ideologues into positions where they simply do not acknowledge that we have an issue. On any of these fronts, I think there are established policies that have demonstrated success with the homeless and with the crime issue that sit out there, and the people making the decisions on this are simply unwilling to put them into place.
How much is unwilling, or how much is incompetent?
Solving the problem.
How much is incompetence? What do you suppose would happen if, you know, I mean, you couldn't do this, I don't know if I'd want to, if you somehow, God, it's sounding like it's a vote and it's not, it's people, if you somehow could gather up, another bad term, 200 randomly selected homeless people from Chicago living in these 10 cities, you go and you grab, well, you can't grab the first five, that's not a random sample, and you bring them someplace, okay, you give them a physical, again, it's somewhat intrusive, interview, figure, where do you think they all came from? Did they have a job 6 months ago, 2 years ago, or are they vets that somehow can't get their way back? And I know that a lot of the problem after Vietnam were people just couldn't come back.
That's a stereotype that doesn't.
I'm saying there were a lot of people. I know people that are still around from Vietnam, Lou. Saying they never really got back in. But my point is, does anybody even know what the problem? Does any?
There's all kinds of data out there. Something like 70% of the chronic homeless, that is people who have been homeless for more than 6 months and are not moving to fix the problem, and that's 70% of them are drug users.
But did that come before or after?
Before what?
They became homeless.
I don't know cause and effect, but whatever it is, the drug use is in debt. It's a huge issue here.
Well, it is here too. Use, I think.
The drug use basically locks these people into a certain lifestyle that they cannot escape from, and don't want to escape from. So about 70% of them have that issue. There's a huge overlap. Something like 35 to 40% have significant mental health issues, to the extent that they are not, you know, curable, either because the drugs that they take don't work, or the drugs that they take work, and then when they get better, they say, "Oh, I'm fine now," and they stop taking them. But they have intractable mental illnesses. So you've got this double whammy of addiction and mental illness that I think comprises something, you know, close to, maybe, I don't know what the number is, 80 to 85%. You've got a 15% of a relatively small cohort that are homeless, but only homeless temporarily. Those people you can reach. You get to those folks and you can sit them down and say, okay, job, here's a job, we can get you into housing, and they'll maintain it. The majority of the other folks, when you take them and give them housing, unless you are prepared to basically establish a police state over that housing, it falls apart, because these people are not making good life choices. They haven't made good life choices for years. They won't make good life choices because of addiction or mental illness or a combination of both. And so, you know, the in Europe, they deal with this, and I gotta say in Europe, in places like Holland or Spain, where they've got a comprehensive program. There's a recognition of this and an understanding that, you know, we're gonna have to hold people accountable for their own decisions, whether their decisions being made because they're mentally ill or because they're drug users, but we're gonna hold them accountable for it. We don't have the political will to do that.
Well,
we throw tens of millions of dollars through you know, charitable organizations and NGOs that are supposed to be managing this program, but instead are perpetuating it.
Yeah, they're perpetuating it. Our buddy, I don't know if he has been a long time. I got to get him back. My psychologist buddy, Dr. Johnson, who was my roommate at school. When he was on last time, we talked about how when somebody ends up homeless in the 10th city, how rapidly you degrade. Maybe the drugs find you there, or maybe they got you there. I don't know which is which for most people, but probably most people, maybe they got them there. But he says, you know, the idea that even if they're younger and healthy, that's what I've noticed here. People in these areas are getting younger all the time. But he says, you know, you're weeks away of treatment and health issues before somebody can work an 8-hour day. You can't show up with a job. That person.
That's correct.
Yeah, you're not. It's going to be a process, even if somebody wants to do better.
But we're not working to. I see Dan's online. I'm not going to hold this too long. If you look at somebody like Michael Schellenberger wrote a great book called San Francisco that talks about San Francisco's drug issues and homeless issues, and contrasts what we do with what, for example, they do in Spain, where you pick people up off the streets. If they're breaking the law, if they're vagrant, if they're shooting up, you arrest them, you put them into rehab programs, you get them detoxed, and then you sit them down, and if they're mentally ill, you force them into treatment. Now, we're not willing to do this, but you force them into treatment, and if they can't, if they're untreatable, then they're taken off the streets. If it's a drug issue, they are detoxed, put in rehab, cleaned up, and then sat down and said, okay, this is your one free bite at the apple. We're not going to put you back in jail. We've got you cleaned up. You've got to get yourself squared away. Here are some options. If we arrest you again, you're going to prison. And it's not going to be a free bite of rehab. You're going to get arrested and pitched into Gen Pop, and you'll dry out there. But we're going to start enforcing, criminal law, public drug use, public intoxication, minor theft or whatever you're doing. But it's a willingness to enforce the law. We don't have a willingness to enforce the law on the guys that are punching windows out of cars in San Francisco.
We don't have that here, but we got a date. But I think, I don't know if they ended up finding it, but the original thought was none of the people who got shot on this train even had an address. But I think maybe a couple of them did. I don't know how that has all worked out, because they identified people, so they must have had some way of doing it. Lou, thank you very much, and enjoy your weekend. You were going to be watching some football. What possessed these guys to go down to Brazil for this game tomorrow night?
I want to know why the NFL is playing a game in Brazil, where the country is basically shutting down free speech for its population.
You sound like my girlfriend. I said the same thing, Audrey.
She's smart.
Yeah, I mean, these countries. Next week, I have this thing. I'll send it to you. Talk about all these water flashpoints around the world. How many wars are about to start in the next 5 years over water? That's just what we need. Another excuse for wars, eh?
Yeah. We don't have enough. All right.
SP futures down 4 and NASDAQ futures up down 52. But why don't we say we go right to Dan? So Dan, how did that 1,000 put you bought in Nvidia last week work out?
It should have worked out great, but I kind of stayed away altogether and just been an observer, and have been making money in the bond market as interest rates come down.
Yeah, it's a good thing. The valuations and so forth are high. You and I have talked about that.
Yeah.
I have some new clients, Dan, and boy, a couple of them have these serious concentration issues in stocks, and boy, that is about the most. I mean, that's something that I think we're better at than just about anybody, but still, that's a real challenge. A person has like one stock that they've had forever, and stock doesn't trade that much, and they would never buy it today, but by the way, they got a low tax basis and this and that. What's going on with the market now with its valuation is causes problems wherever you are if you're managing money for people.
Yeah, absolutely, and then the volatility on top of that, which has just really increased tremendously the last few months, is just not helping things. And for a lot of individual investors, or a lot of people who are looking at their accounts and watching their NVIDIAs go on this roller coaster ride, it's not going to stop. I just think if people have to realize, if they don't have the stomach for that, and if they don't want to see losses, even day-to-day losses in their portfolio, then they need to lighten up. And I've been pushing that since the beginning of this year. Sell into the rally, sell into the strength and the momentum. You don't have to sell all of it, but just as you're saying, if you're in a concentrated position, diversify that risk. Get out of some of that. There's still plenty of other good alternatives for investing right now, and you can do that without having the level of concentration risk or event risk or stock specific risk or technology risk or a lot of these companies are actually laying off. I mean, look at Intel. look at the performance of Intel stock, and you look at the performance of, you know, of some of these other companies that have started that process of laying off, talking to people, clients, and other people who work for firms that are in the tech industry, whether it be Amazon or Microsoft or one of the other firms, and just understanding that the benefits that they used to provide are just not there anymore. So, and they can't, it used to be, it was even just a few years ago when these tech people, people in the technology industry that had some really good skill sets, could just jump from place to place and make more money. That's starting to fade. And you know, with the jobs report that came out, there are fewer jobs out there right now. It's harder for those people, and it's a large group of our working population that work for these tech companies, and it's very, very difficult for them to have that same advantage, if you will, or that same luxury, if you will, that they had even just a few years ago.
Yeah, how, you know, it's not that we have Nance and Audrey on here today, but how long, I mean, I think you and I will heartily discuss things from different sides a lot, and that's basically educational for both of us and I think for other people. But what, and neither one of us are real estate experts, but how long can the real estate prices, if you have an area, I'll just pick a name, if you have an area like the, you know, the Valley in California where everybody's making a fortune and real estate prices reflect that, and all of a sudden you lay off, you know, let's say 5, 10, 15, what's the number where one starts to affect the other? Is it a day? Is it a other stuff affects it? Is it just if?
Yeah. So actually, I think I have an answer to that because I've been thinking about that a lot as well, and you know, just very, you know, wowed by the fact that in the Northeast, you know, where I grew up, and not only in Boston area, but you know, people that have relocated to the Cape Cod, or they've relocated to New Hampshire and Maine. I mean, prices in Portland, Maine are similar to prices, real estate prices in Boston now, just because so many people have moved. And there are bidding wars still there. So there's a lot of money that is still chasing the market. Contrast that with Florida, where the housing prices have been down 10% just this year in many locations, especially in Southwest Florida, you know, for a number of reasons, including the overbuilding, the large supply, all the issues with condos having to be up to code, especially issues with insurance, the cost for somebody who's living in Florida, who's retired on a fixed income, it's becoming unaffordable. So that's driving the property values down there. So as your question being, how soon does it take? Well, it takes place over a period of time, but sometimes it takes place and you don't even realize how much it's going on. So you have to be an observer. You have to look outside. If you're in a neighborhood with a second home in Florida, for example, and you're in a neighborhood and you're questioning all the new development that's going to be competing with you when you put your market on the house on the market, you really got to start digging in and doing a little research and finding out what's going on there and what will be going on there. And I can assure you prices will continue to come down regardless of whether our economy continues to grow. It's just a question of supply and demand that's out of balance there. But I would, to sort of answer your question, I would say it takes place over time, but it takes place in such a way that we don't even realize how much it's changing until we're actually looking at it and saying, oh yeah, my buddy is trying to sell his house and he's already had to drop the price 20%. That's I think how it happens.
Well, you know, it's
not focused on real estate right now. They're not focused. Even if you listen to Bloomberg, CNBC, Fox Business News, they're all focused on the election. So we're not getting a lot of that information. So you have to dig a little bit to get that information. You have to do your own search to find out what's going on in those markets, those housing markets, those regional markets.
Well, there was a dude, I didn't see him before, and I was kind of talking to a client, so I was hearing him one ear, but he was on CNBC yesterday, and he was talking about Doggy Downer, but he was just talking about NVIDIA and a lot of these other stocks, and he goes, these things are incredibly expensive. And if they start going down, you can't say, oh, by the way, it's down 10%. You know, that's it. It's by the dip, which he goes, basically what you've been hearing all day. He goes, it may be just the start. He goes, because we're not down to where anything is a scream and buy just on performance and dividends, and you're going to get the check, and you really don't care if it goes lower. Because we're not anywhere near that kind of valuation after one day. Because we're not talking about, yeah. I'll buy the six flat for $1 million because I know I'm going to get a $100,000 check every year. I don't care if appraisal is 950 6 months from now, as long as I'm getting my 100,000 check every year. We're not anywhere near close to any of these companies.
I think the part that's scary is just thinking that with that decline in the price of NVIDIA stock, such a huge number, if you look at the overall number, is being taken out of our economy. So that's where the concern comes in, is just that the bloat in these companies, you know, is similar in some ways to the bloat that we saw in the dot-com bubble, the bloat that we saw in the SNL crisis. When you have that level of bloat where the companies get overvalued and they're representing such a large part of the capitalization of our financial markets or economy, that's when it gets scary, because a little flip like that on piece of news can take a big chunk out of our economy.
What have you seen, Dan? I'm trying to do this correlation, which maybe isn't there, between real estate and the market. I mean, basically, I say I think the seven stocks are priced to perfection, I'll say. Well, NVIDIA's down a bunch, but $300 billion in one day in market cap? Wow, that's a number, huh?
That's a big number.
But you look at it and you say, but I mean, I'll be perfectly blunt. I mean, I'm aware, and I hope listeners are, and certainly my clients, that if we have a discussion this week and there's extra cash in somebody's account, and even if we protect it, and I say, okay, what do you want to do? And they'll say, well, let's do the spiders. Let's do the Qs. I hope everybody understands that the $200,000 we put in the spiders, 49 of it is going into those seven stacks.
Right, it's going right back in.
So even if you think those are the ones you don't like, if you're doing any kind of indexing, you're basically buying them. And when you do stuff with the indexing, you're just like people who put, you know, $200 a week in their 401k plan, which I hope people do, especially if it matches. You could sit there and, I mean, I don't know if I ever told you this kind of long, boring story, Dan, but we did a seminar once, and, we did a lot of seminars, and I always ask when, it's my turn to talk, you know, what's everybody doing here? Why is everybody, what are you doing here on a Saturday morning? I know we got good rolls and coffee, but you're here for more than that, right? And one guy raises his hand, and he goes, I'm here because I know I've heard, and this is when Jan and I were on the score, I've heard you're the best bear market trader there is. And I said, well, I don't know about that necessarily, but because if you can make money in a down market, I want to talk to you. And I said, all right, well, I have, but sometimes I hadn't too as well. But, you got to be truthful with people. And I said, so he goes, I'm so bearish I can taste it. And I said, okay, so you want to, we're talking about general markets and individual stocks. And he says, just the general market. I think we're going basically into crapo. And I said, all right, so what do your investments look like right now? And, feel free to not tell people what you have. I said, do you have a 401k plan? Well, yeah. I said, well, do you contribute every week? Well, absolutely. I get a match. And I said, all right, what are you in there in, like, some fixed income? Why would I be in fixed income? I'm in stocks. I'm going, okay, then.
And, yeah.
So let me get this straight. I'm not trying not to give you grief, but you're doing it to yourself, basically.
Absolutely.
You're so bearish you could taste it. All of your real wealth is in stocks. And, oh, by the way, you bought more this week.
I hear that all the time.
Yeah.
From friends and from people across the board, and certainly not from my clients, but we had a remarkable day on Tuesday. I mean, our accounts were up big, and that's what happens when interest rates go down and when you're invested in bonds and when you're invested properly and wisely and with some thought, not just throwing your money into an ETF. But we're which you don't want to do, by the way, with bonds. You want to buy individual bonds. So we had a great day. And, I was talking to people who were talking about the amount of money that they lost in just that one day. And just as you're saying, Chief, and I agree with you 100%, the choice is yours. It's right in front of you, You can put a little bit of that into a protected strategy and into fixed income, and you don't have to sell all of it, but if you are bearish or you have concerns, or even if you don't have concerns, you need to be diversified, because there are these exogenous events. There's an event like what happened on Tuesday that took $300 billion out of the market, you know, just in a day. So that protection is so important, and people have forgotten. They've become do-it-yourselfers. They've forgotten that there will be a downturn. And then, fortunately, there are guys like us that have been around long enough that haven't forgotten, and just are trying to guide our clients and guide the listeners to realize that taking a little bit of it off the table right now is a good time. You know,
but then that conversation.
Like roller coasters, and you like looking at your account every day, and you get and you have a bad day when it's down, you have a good day when it's up. I mean, that's like this bipolar. You know, you're going to be feeling, you know, you can't do that for one, and then you're also going to be disappointed pretty frequently because we are going to have more down days going forward.
Dan, how do you have the conversation? And this, you know, when you have this is real money. I mean, we're talking about with people, so it's you somehow have to be. I use the term blunt, but you don't necessarily want to be blunt ever with a client, but sometimes you have to be blunt. And but it's been so long, Dan. It's been since 2000, sort of. If you'd have bought the bottom there, or certainly since 2008. Where with a few blips along the way, all you want to do is be stone cold long, right? And you're the entire investment community, the people you hear on TV, radio, all the time, basically, you throw them money, they charge you a percent and a half or something, or one, or depending on which money you have, and they basically put it in the market, and if it goes up, they pat themselves on the back. There's no hedging, there's no account for your age, there's nothing like that. And for how many years nobody touched fixed income? I mean, right, because why would you do that? It's 1% when the market's making 10% a year. I mean, what are you, some kind of idiot? But now there's some sort of a tone change where guys in the fixed income industry who manage the weather, the no fixed income storm, guys like you, are actually doing pretty well for people. And, oh, by the way, it's a return that's not nothing. It's not 20% or it's not 15% like 1980, but it's something, and it's real. And, oh, by the way,
yeah,
the market.
Yeah, in my case, it's close to double digits.
Yeah, I mean, well, I'm saying, but you're good at it. I'm talking just in generalities.
I agree. But I absolutely agree.
But I mean, if you, I have one person I'm talking to. I think a potential client. Matter of fact, I'm pretty sure he's going to be a client. It's you got to be so gentle, Dan, because I'm going to say the dude's 80. All right, and when he started this, giving it to whoever he's. And he's just stone cold long. He was still working. He was 62, 63. And yet, and now he's got this hunk of dough, basically, in stocks. It's that conversation. This has worked for so long. Why should I try something different? Well, because maybe the world's turned a little bit. And how do you say, but by the way, you're also not working. If you'd have lost what you had when you were 61, you could have made up in 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
You lose this now. There's no coming back from it. I mean, it's just a tough conversation to have with people.
It is, but here's what I say when I'm in that situation. You want to preserve and you want to capture all those years of hard work, you know, all those years that you've put money away. Now that you're retired, you want to capture that. You want to preserve that so that you can live in retirement very comfortably. And after reviewing the, you know, what they have, and if they have made that much, you know, generally what I say to people is you can live the same way as you had in the past, and you can reduce your level of risk and the level of volatility in your account tremendously. And this is the time to do it. You can do it right now.
Well,
I'm doing it with my own account.
Well, yeah.
And it's working. It's working.
As you know, I'm the option, you know, for lack of better terms, I've done it my whole life. I can do better with an option position than anybody can do without it, I think, in terms of you. But I'll tell you what, this VIX sliding up here like this, and the VIX is 21, if you have a stock, you know, whatever it is, I'll just look at my screen, McDonald's, Triple M, whatever it is, you want to buy some insurance out a year, you're paying. I mean, these puts are
absolutely
getting high.
Yeah.
Because the market's telling you, it's it's so bizarre, Dan, and I, you know, we're going to talk fixed income here in a minute, but it's so bizarre that the price gives you the message. It's just like, I mean, there's been times when you and I, you know, maybe let's say could have afforded a Corvette. Now, I can't fit in one, but if I bought one, if I wanted to buy one, and I go, oh, that's $50,000. All right, well, I can do that. How much is the insurance? Well, that's $15,000 a year. I go, wait a minute. What do I got to do? Chain this thing to the curb? The cost of insurance gives me a slap upside the head and look how risky it is to own this thing. So if you look at, like, NVIDIA's implied volatility has gone up, or a lot of these stocks, if you look at it and say, okay, you know, pick, I don't know what the puts are. Pick, I actually was looking at, I look at all of them all day long, so I don't really want to pick a stock. But in other words, if you look at Microsoft, I don't even know what the puts are. It's trading 405. It's down $3. If you look at the 400 puts out a year, and they're like $35 or something, and when money be more than that, and you sit there and go, well, that's high. That should be a message to you that says, that's how likely the market thinks that this thing's going to be down more than $35.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a message there, right? It's not just these market makers got these puts too high. They don't make the price. The rest of the world does. They're telling you how risky this stuff is by the price of the insurance, right?
Yep. And it's the exact same thing, Tom, in the bond market. So the spread, you know, the yield pickup that you get over treasuries is what determines what the market perceives as risk. So when now that rates are coming down, the spread is widening out. There's been a lot of new issuance of high grade or investment grade corporate bonds this past week, and it's been eaten up. I mean, and in fact, those bonds have actually rallied during this time. So there are a lot of smart investors who've been participating here, but there will be a point when that spread widens out, when there's a lot of inventory in the market, and when there's less certainty of the future. So it's when you have that spread widening that you have the opportunity, but it's basically the same thing as looking at the insurance, the cost of the insurance, and saying, look, the market is already accounting in, you know, a correction or, you know, some sort of, you know, there's some additional risk that needs to be taken care of here. And in your case, you need to do that by buying or paying more for insurance.
What do you make of, you and I, since neither one of us are CPAs, we don't necessarily give tax advice. What's your opinion on if somebody drops a whole bunch of stock on you they've had forever? I guess I'm saying that this has been happening a lot to me lately, and I always want other people's opinions, especially people like Dan. If it's just too much in one spot, one stock, I mean, nobody likes to pay taxes, but capital gains rates for the first, what, half a million bucks is only it's 15%.
Right.
Over that, it's 20. And maybe whoever gets in office, the federal government's broke, and by the way, the tax rates are going to go back up in 26, right? I mean, I don't know that if the Democrats get in, they're probably definitely not going to extend them. But if the Republicans get in, I'm not so sure they can extend them either because of the deficit.
Yeah, I just heard that part of Harris's plan is to keep the highest bracket at 28, not 33, which is what Biden had suggested.
So
Capital gains tax, yeah. Right.
So, I mean, I don't know that the Republicans, given the budget deficit right now, essentially have the stones to push all those tax things out. Some of it's going to get, in my opinion, but that's not the point. I guess what I'm saying is if somebody has this big, fat profit in the stock for 20, 30, 40 years they've had it, should you just sell a little bit of it and pay to 15%? It's not, unless you're going to croak in the next 6 months and give it to your kids and get the step-up basis, if you're planning on living 20 years, I don't know that you're not better off just selling 20% of it and write the check.
So a couple things. I think it depends on your income bracket at the time where you're selling it. But more importantly, I think depends on the stock. So if it does have upside potential, if it's sort of a steady eddy stock that should continue to do well, I would sell it gradually. I'd sell it a little bit at a time. That would be my recommendation. Not selling it, not dumping it all at once.
Well, I'm that's not what I mentioned. I just said, suppose somebody dropped an account on you and it's right, it's $5 million, and it's three stocks.
Right.
And they've been around forever, and you sit there and go, "Do you want me to? Do you really want me to buy puts on these things for the next 10 years, or should we just lighten up here, diversify around, and maybe I'll buy puts on half of what?" Is it even part of the question? Hey, you know, write the check here. I mean, it's
if it's if it's going up, you just buy more. I don't know if you guys got that memo.
Well, that's right. If it's going up, you just keep buying more.
Right.
Go out on margin. Go out on margin and buy more. Right.
Yeah.
You can always do that. Well, yeah. You got a hunch, bet a bunch, right, Greg? What was the?
I mean,
what was it back in the day?
Don't need to overthink this one.
What was the? Was it the T-shirt back in the day from the Cactus? Don't drink and trade small.
Yeah.
I can see you wearing one of those, Dan. Don't drink and trade. Then the bottom of it had big letters, paper letters, small. There you have it. All right. So what do you make? I'm looking at the. This is not a well. I guess it's somewhat of a political question. Our 3 month is down from, what do we get, Dan? 5.5. It's down to 5. And the Treasury yields, but it's still, you know, still there.
The higher yields are still in the 1 month and the eight.
But what? Why is the? I guess this is a political question. Why is the Fed, who's obviously already poured enough money into the system to make these rates go down, why are they hemming and hawing about actually telling you they're doing it? They're doing it.
They are doing it, yeah. And the market is responding. In fact, this morning it looks as if they're responding to a larger cut than, you know, the original 25. However, I think 25 is really what would be best for September. And the interesting thing is we had a slight pick time, a very short period of time with the yield curve turned positive from twos to tens. And generally what that means is that it's good news for the economy. It's good news for the forecast for the economy.
Well, I've got it flat.
But interesting the way that the market looked at that is they said, well, yeah, the jobs data came out and the jobs data was not very strong, and as a result, for a period of time, the market turned positive. Actually, that could be part of the reason that happened. But the yield curve turning positive does not indicate a recession or a slowdown. An inverted yield curve generally does.
I got the 2 and 10 even, 3.12.
Right now they're even, right? Yeah. And that's good. The flattening is a good thing. There's definitely good news. I mean, the bond market is smart, and they're smart right now in the way they're trading. The bond market is generally smarter than the equity market. There's no question.
Well, when people say, you hear that on TV all the time, that the bond market is anticipating this. Me being the knucklehead monetarist that I am, I don't think the bond market's done anything. The Fed has poured money into the system. They've lowered the rate.
Yes.
From 5.5 to 5. I mean, the market just recognizes the fact that, there's more money here. I guess I can't charge as much, or I can get it cheaper. It's just the market. They regulate the amount of water in the pool in the short end, right?
Right.
And they poured more money in the pool.
It is a response to the Fed's move as opposed to the market doing its own thing. And it's the way the yield curve is shaped currently, you still pay more to be in the short end. So I would recommend to listeners, our strategy continues to be to stay invested in the short end, not only because you get more yield still, but more importantly because there's going to be continued volatility on the long end. The worst thing that you want to do is go long expecting to make money and then have rates either do nothing or possibly go up, because then you get whipsawed and the price of your bonds goes down when rates go up. So that's a simple concept, but for a lot of people that's hard to understand. So I would say first, stay on the short end with your investments. It's okay to buy some of these high-grade corporate bonds that are coming to market. You'll get paid a little bit more, and I'll go back to municipal bonds. If you have an account that's taxable, munis look cheap. They're still a really good purchase right now. Stay on the short end.
Dan, how do you find the munis that if you need to get out, you can get out?
Generally buying ones that have a little more liquidity, that are larger issue size. We have an advantage in trading because we trade in the institutional market. we have a much better advantage than retail investors. So you know, recommend that they give, you know,
yeah,
well, they take, put their money with me, because that's where we really can add value.
Well, you can educate me for sure. I mean, we do a lot of bonds because people bring them in, but we're not a bond house like you obviously have been with. It, but out of all the, I mean, maybe Chicago, just don't put the disparaging part about the crime and everything about Chicago, but in the state of Illinois, with all the cities and towns and all the stuff in the state and the city, what percentage of bonds would you say are at least as liquid as a crummy stock? It can't be 10% of them, is it?
It could be 10%, yeah. I mean, really, so here's the thing. So you're looking at individual issuance.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
So individual issuance, you have a large issue of Chicago GOs or State of Illinois GOs, general obligation bonds. You have a large issue of those, and say it's a couple of billion dollars. That's going to represent a large portion of the municipal bonds that have been issued by the State of Illinois. So the ones where you can make a little more money would be specific bonds that would have to do with, say, a school district in, you know, one of the northern suburbs of Chicago, which probably would be a good long-term purchase. Those are going to be more of your buy and hold stocks, but you're going to be buying on the short end, not on the long end. You're looking for that yield. If you get 5% or more, that's 7%+ after tax, and talking about double A rated bond. So it's okay, depending on the level of liquidity. You don't trade in and out of municipal bonds like you would stocks. You don't, that's not, you know, you don't trade in and out of them. You don't try to time the market with municipals. You look for the best values, and you look for the tax advantage. And if you are wanting to have more liquidity, you stick with a larger issuance size. Those are generally general obligation bonds, GO bonds.
But if you want
Wisconsin, very high rated state, you go with the GO bonds. But if you want to get that extra yield, which is what we do, we seek the extra yield. We look at bonds that are decent issue size, that are double A rated, where you're getting 5.5%. So you're after, you know, your tax equivalent yield is like 7.5%. But there might be a liquidity issue. In other words, you're not going to be able to necessarily sell it all at once. We have a huge advantage being institutional, especially when it comes to municipal bonds, because I'm able to have access to institutional pricing in the institutional market. I'm not trading with retail investors or individual investors. I'm trading with larger institutions that trade municipal bonds more frequently.
Well,
and that's what I used to do.
Well, you want to be on the side of if somebody has a, I use the term 20-year bond, say in, you know, like a North Shore, that's not a city, but somewhere up there, and somebody for whatever reason needs to sell it with 3 years to go, you want to be the guy that can buy it there, and then maybe if your client holds it for 3 years, he doesn't have to sell it again. He's going to get the check.
Yeah, I mean, you get the interest too.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. But I'm saying that's the ideal situation, is you sort of match the bond up, which as long as you want to be out there.
It's much more complex with bonds, because it's still a dealer's market, and they still trade in the secondary market, and so you can actively trade them. And depending on the specific bond, let's say, you know, I don't know if Evanston has any bonds outstanding, but if it was a place that you had, you know, had a high rated, and you say you had a 5 or 7 year bond, there wouldn't be a reason to sell it, and I would have those would be the ones that I would hold on to for the extra yield. I would sell corporate bonds. I'd sell stocks before I would sell them. So these would be, you know, these would be your buy and hold stocks. But yeah, you could do that. I'm buying from an ETF. I'm buying from a fund. I might be buying from an institution that has a large number. So I'm seeing, you know, a huge number of bonds that are available, and then I might spread them out amongst accounts. So we do have that trading advantage, and the price is much better, because the bid offered in municipal bonds could be as wide as 10 points.
Well, some of the stuff we've gotten here and people brought in, not so much lately, but years ago, somebody had a, I think we ended up getting halfway decent price, but God bless it, Dan, it took like a month. It was a some kind of Philadelphia TIFF bond or something.
Yeah, I remember those TIFF bonds.
Oh, God. I think the market was like 20 bid at 90 or something.
Yeah. Yeah, and see, that's where you have a huge advantage on the institutional side, because you're dealing with the larger players in the market, whether they be mutual funds, ETFs, whether they be large corporations that have a taxable accounts. Used to be the nuclear power plants had, you know, there was a certain accounts that they would have that were taxable, and so you put a lot of municipal bonds into those accounts. So there's a much better market in the institutional market. It's true with bonds in general. It would be true with high yield bonds, it would be true with corporate bonds, it would be true with mortgage bonds. And that's why, that's the advantage that we add over trying to buy something on your own. And one thing I will say, because I've had a few people bring this up even this past week, oh, I'll just put money in a bond fund. Well, I used to manage bond funds for a long time, municipal and taxable bond funds. When you buy a mutual fund that has bonds on it, in it, you're not setting your duration, you're not setting your average maturity. You're buying a pool of bonds. There is something called capital gains distribution tax. You don't have that when you buy individual bonds, but when you buy a mutual fund, whether or not the NAV, the price of that fund, is going up or not, at the end of the year, you have to pay capital gains distribution taxes, and that can add up. So I would tell people to highly avoid funds.
If they lost money, you get the deduction too?
If they lost money overall, it would be, yes, they could take it as a loss.
I mean, if they bought...
But even if they can lose money and then still have to pay capital gains distribution taxes.
Right, but I'm saying if you, this is getting a little too technical probably, but if somebody were to have bought bonds, say, 3 years ago when they were, you know, and actually in the fund bought a bond at 120 and puked it out at 100, that's a loss. If the loss is greater than the capital gains, you're gonna get a piece of that loss too, aren't you?
It's you know, I'm not an accountant, but I will say that they're two separate
okay
issues. But what does tend to happen with people who buy fixed income mutual funds is that they get surprised at later having to pay these capital gains distribution. It's just not something that, you know, I think a lot of people are aware of, because people aren't thinking that that's what happens when you buy
one. One is the value of the account with the NAV, and the other is whether they sold anything at a profit, and you got to pay for it, right? Two
yes,
separate things.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, even if at the end of the year, say, the NAV is down, anything that's been sold as a profit during the year, you're paying capital gains distribution. You got it. That's exactly what it is.
We say we go to a real quick break here and then come on back. It's interesting stuff. S&P futures down 11, NASDAQ futures down 88. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
My advice to you, start drinking heavily. My advice to you, start drinking heavily.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm coming out with Greg Pappas on the board. S&P futures down 11. NASDAQ futures down 90. Why was the most improbable no-hitter at even more improbable venue occurred on September 14, 2008 at Miller Park in Milwaukee. For the second time in the ballpark's existence, the home team for a baseball game was not the Brewers. Nobody could imagine what fate had in store for Carlos Zambrano and his team that night. Due to perceived damage and havoc of Hurricane Ike as it approached the Texas Panhandle, Major League Baseball moved the Cubs-Houston series from Houston to the guaranteed site of Miller Park in Milwaukee, which had a retractable roof. There you go.
Interesting.
Yeah, it was a. I remember watching. Zambrano was a. Was kind of a character. He was a very flamboyant, and he was a tremendous hitter. You wonder if in today's day and age with the DHs, if he would have been. He used to come out of batting practice, whack home runs for like half hour just to show everybody else how far he could hit them. He was a, you know, he could have been. I mean, he wasn't near as good as Ohtani, but I think that guy could have been a DH on his off days easily. But he was one of the, you know, boy, it's hard to say something about somebody's personality, but he always had this, you know, volatile sort of personality. And as soon as he got the big contract, he was unconscionable. You couldn't even deal with the guy. But he had talent, you know, out the behind basically on just about everything. SP futures down 13. NASDAQ futures down 100. We're going to go quick here. Over in Asia, we've got the Nikkei down another 391%. So they're down right 3-4 days in a row. They're 36,657. Hang Seng down 13, 17,444. Shanghai up 4, but 27,88. I'm going to get Dan's read on the China situation as well, because their manufacturing was down. All kinds of stuff's down over there. Europe got the DAX down 2, call that flat. FTSE down 20.2%. Kekaran's got some heat to the downside here, down 59.8%. Yesterday, as a way to review, Dow was up 38, S&P down 8, NASDAQ down 52, and for me, it was an absolute classic day after a big move, back and forth, back and forth, back and forth, and then nothing. Well, today, maybe we'll see something definitive. Either we're going to bounce back here or hopefully not go further. Bonds down 3 basis points, 3.73. The Bund down 2 basis points, 2.20. Japan down 1 at 0.87. Oil. These guys, Dan, we were talking earlier about a couple of years from now, they claim Saudi Arabia is breaking even where all the people they pay over there and all their infrastructure stuff is $100. Well, it's under 70 today, 69.92. That's not going to get it for them. Brent up 75 cents, 73.45. Natural gas up 3 cents, 217. Gold with a pretty big rally, up $24, 25.49. It's been leaking down. The last couple of days with the market, but now it's back up today. Silver up 55 cents, 29.11. That's the volatile one. FX, the dollar is 111 on the euro, where it has been, 132 against the British pound, where it has been. Bitcoin down again today, $1,400, 56,502. Greg, real quick, traffic, weather, sports, and we get back to Dan and ask him where the minefields might be, if there are any.
Where's the minefields?
Yeah.
They're right here.
Well, yeah, that is. We're going to see if he knows any different ones or if he thinks the ones we think are minefields aren't.
All right, here we go. We got 74 here right now, or 65 here with the real feel at 68. I want to say 87 high. Tonight we could have a couple of showers and a thunderstorm. Be prepared for, let's see. Reduced visibility and ponding in the streets. That was new from earlier.
Yeah.
Phoenix, 89 right now. Very hot, blazing sunshine. High of 114 today.
Is that going to be 103 in a row over 100? The old record was 76.
They're saying everybody needs to stay indoors. Traffic's getting worse by the minute also here. Kennedy from Montrose, 72 minutes. Eden's Lake Cook to the interchange is 108 minutes. That's the worst I've seen it in a long time. Eisenhower, we've got from Wolf, it's 60 minutes. The Ryan from 95th to 290 is 37 minutes, and the Stevenson is 42 minutes from 294 to the Ryan. And then we had the NFL kicking off tonight, 7:20, Ravens at Chiefs. KC's favored by 3. And yesterday, White Sox beat the Orioles. That was 8-1. Cubs no-hit the Pirates. That was their first no-hitter in 52 years at Wrigley. And then the Diamondbacks beat the Giants 6-4. So
right,
you got, Chief?
Right before Milt Pappas was Kenny Holzman. And he had two. He had one in Cincinnati against the Big Red Machine. Then we had the perfect game with Mark Burley not that long ago, right? Long ago, but not like 50 years. It was like 5 years ago, right? Or eight. He pitched the perfect game at Sox Park. I believe he did. Anyway, Dan, is you get in these situations where, by historical standards, a lot of stocks are pretty high. A lot of them aren't. I mean, there's still, if you're a fundamental trader, well, you find stocks here that are relative, well, not even relative, but even kind of a bargain, and they don't go anywhere, and you shake your head, right? But then you watch some of the other ones, you sit there and go, these things are awful high, and they keep moving. Some of it is the phenomenon that they're a big enough piece of the indexes that people buy on a weekly basis, right? So there's going to be demand there kind of no matter what, just piling out of 401 or even IRAs. But you don't get too many people and the, I'm not going to compare PTI to Merrill Lynch, but there aren't a whole lot of people that throw $100.
PTI is still in business.
Yeah, well, that's true. but we don't have a whole lot of people that send us like 200 a week, you know, right off the payroll like you would in a 401k. Right, because that's a lot easier. So we really don't have that constant dribble here of people into the spiders or the queues, right, Greg? But now, if it's 401k, you do, right? I mean, every week people put a couple hundred bucks in, or 2 weeks whenever you get paid, and a lot of people are into the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ or something, right, Dan? And so you're going to get this drain in, and, you know, usually you'll see some mutual fund buying on the close, and sometimes not. But then there's some stuff, the valuation gets to a level and you sit there and go, boy, you know, the risk in this might be the downside actually for once. Usually stocks go up. Most years they go up. Yet we have this China situation. It seems like it's getting worse over there. And yet we know, you and I know, but we can't quantify, you may be better than me, how much U.S. money is over there, how much of it is non-participating in interest, how much of it's flat out gone. Over the years, have these companies, I'll use a term like somebody huge like BlackRock, is it down to where it's 4 or 5% of their capital, and even if it gets really bad, it's nothing they can't weather? Is it, you know, I think the pension fund in California, CalPERS, was a big China investor. Over a period of time, has that dropped down to where it's not a worry? Is it a worry? Is somebody going to go under? Is some bank? How do you dig out where the actual landmine is in front of you? I mean, you know, there's some out there, but the real estate thing. How many more buildings can trade for $40 million? You know, 5 years ago were $130 million or something. And where does that $90 million come from? Does it come from a bank that, or a capital fund that has so much money they made somewhere else? It's, you know, it's a pimple on the ass of an elephant. How do you figure out where the problems are, and if they're big enough to cause a bigger problem or not, or who's got it? Is it some small bank that's going to go under? And you know, I guess you get the question. It's a long question.
Yeah. So, talk a little about China, and then also talk a little about Japan and the contrast. So with China, I would say that the large institutional investors, you know, you're talking about CalPERS or you know, California's retirement plan, or some other big institutional investors that have had money there. I would say that one of the great things about having been an institutional manager most of my career is, you know, being on these boards and making decisions to manage risk. So when it comes to a larger pension plan, a foundation, a state pension plan, even a municipal, you know, a more local pension plan, there are rules set in place as to the allocation that you can have. And I would say that for the average CIO running them, and I used to do that myself, that we're going to stay within those parameters. So you're not going to have a super large investment in China. That just is not the way that those large funds run. Now, there may be some investors, we were thinking about Orange County, where they had, you know, there were some issues there. So there may be some CIOs or some groups or some boards that have made decisions to go long. I would say they are the exception to the rule, so that I don't think there is as much exposure in some of these, say, large pension plans, large public pension plans, large corporate pension plans. There might be more in companies that have investments in China. So you have a corporation that has an investment there, so they're going to tag along in their retirement plan. But in general, I don't think that's where the landmines are. I think they're in other places, but I don't think that's where they are. They could be local investors in real estate. That could be, you know, people that, it could be the hedge funds, it could be the people who are looking outside of our value, overvalued markets for opportunity, and they're just looking in the wrong place.
Well,
so that would be the answer to that.
Well, a big part of me says, you're absolutely right. I mean, these people, if they did their job right, they would be at a level at which we can deal with it. But I also, in my other side of my wacky head is, for 5 years, if you didn't say the word China every four words on CNBC, you were hustled off the stage. I mean, if you didn't put money over there, you're an idiot. And I mean, somebody's got money over there. I mean, you would think. I don't know who it is.
Yeah, I just think it's becoming, I hate to use the word passé, but it's sort of becoming passé right now as an investment. And if what you're getting to is, yeah, over the years people have been putting money in there, I do think the smart boards have been lightening up those positions. They've been diversifying into other places that have better opportunities. So I'm not sure that there are places, I'm sure, that have large exposure. But I would say in general, that isn't really going to be a major concern.
Okay, so what is? I'll push that one aside. You answered that question. Now, commercial real estate, is that not a problem either?
Commercial real estate is really transitioning right now. So again, it depends on the city, but there's been a lot of places that have refit, if you will. So there might have been a large commercial property, say in downtown New York or downtown Boston, downtown LA, that was housing a lot of law firms, investment firms, say, different companies. And what has happened with them, from my research, is that they have been fortunate to have either renegotiated their leases, or they've been fortunate to be able to have kept their leases going in a way that's why a lot of these firms are making people come back to work. So that sort of work from home phenomenon is being challenged by the CEOs of the companies that still have physical office space, but still want people to come in the office to share that, you know, that human contact. And so what I'm hearing is that is not as severe a situation because it's been worked out in many cases. What happens in the future, I'm not sure. I'm not sure it's the best investment going forward in the future, but I do know that there a lot of these buildings have been repurposed for different things. Some of them, Boston is very well known for turning an office building into a condo, or turning a church into a condo, or turning a school when it closed into a condo. So there's a repurposing going on, a changing of, and so I do think that it's going to be okay, but I don't think it would be a good investment.
Because I mean, when you see a building like one in Chicago, I think they were into it for $40, $45 million, the owners. They basically said, we're out and kicked it to the bank. So that $40, $45 million, I guess if it's the federal government, it disappears, huh? But somewhere, $40 million's got to leave a mark.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I'm not sure that I think the issue is getting resolved in a lot of places. I think there are going to be parts of the country that are going to be hurt by that, just as there are in the retail housing market in Florida, as I mentioned, just the overbuilding. So that's an issue. One thing I want to make sure we get a couple minutes in for is talking about Japan.
Oh yeah,
because Japan has been in the news. The market, the yen has actually appreciated in value. They've had increases in rates, kind of the opposite of what we're seeing in most of the rest of the world. But the interesting thing that happened that caught my attention was Nippon Steel, the potential purchase, the bid for U.S. Steel. And very interesting that I think at least with the Harris administration, Biden-Harris, like really wanting to block that. And I think that's a positive thing in terms of keeping you know, keeping money here in the States and keeping our, you know, making sure that our companies thrive and not, you know, that, that sort of, for those years after years after years, we were having not only the Japanese, but Chinese and other foreign countries coming in and buying up our real estate, buying up our companies. And it's very smart that I think the administration is now either putting a stop to that or at least cutting back on that or you know, focused on it, I think is the most important thing. And also the concern about really not looking at tax cuts or tariffs. I think that's becoming very, very passe, looking more at integrating the economy, focusing on the U.S. economy. Those are all very positive things. And without getting too political, I think that that's the direction that we need to go in to alleviate the problems, Chief, that you're talking about, where we have that overinvestment coming from overseas, or we have the states, we have the United States making large purchases in you know, in foreign countries, including China. I think the hedge funds will still be at the forefront of that, but there's this sort of back to the USA, like, you know, and I think that, I hope that theme continues, because I think it'll be very good for our economy and also very good for the financial markets.
Well, Dan, how do you, you know, we talked, we don't have time today, but we have talked various times on the show, you and I, a little bit, and other people, whether the current corporate structure responds to what not just the shareholders want or the workers want. I mean, to me, going forward, if everybody isn't provided for, you're not going to be a 100-year company. But now this particular thing with, I could probably speculate, I'm going to say the biggest single winners in this whole mess are the people who run U.S. Steel. I mean, they're going to, their stock options, they're going to take their check and they're going to be gone, and they could care less if anybody has a job 5 years from now. My guess is, I mean, maybe they do just because they're decent people, but this decision is clearly not one where you think outside the boardroom, right? I mean, if people on the board have stock options, all of a sudden they're going to make $20 million on this deal, I don't think they're going to worry too much about Joe Jamoke working at Gary Works, do you?
Yeah, I mean, the from that point of view, just kind of looking at it more from the board point of view and internally in the company point of view, a lot of people are looking for their exit strategy as well, individuals in general. I think I know the company and I've actually invested in it in the bonds for years and years. This is really where our homework and getting to know CEOs and senior management makes a big difference, because there are senior managers that have great visions in terms of looking at the future and looking at the continuity of the business and looking how to restructure the business so that it, you know, it's at its best. And sometimes these purchases that come in, external purchases that come in, may be good for the, I think this is what you're alluding to, Chief, the current, you know, management team, and not really so much looking at where it's going forward. But that's why we do our homework, because we're long-term investors, and we're looking for those companies that are positioning themselves for the long term and are not looking for a quick exit strategy for their senior officers.
Dan, what happens if, again, we might run over a couple minutes because we started a couple minutes late, but this particular situation, man, I don't know, you probably do off the top of your head, the different ratings of Nippon versus U.S. Steel, right? So suppose a guy like you figured U.S. Steel were good bonds, and you went out and got some of your clients in these bonds, and you're basically sitting there happy. Now, if U.S. Steel is a single A rated, and Nippon comes in there, and it's an all cash deal from stuff they've, you know, been saving, and they're a double A rated, I have to believe that maybe the price of your bonds are going to go up, and your assuredness of getting paid is even better, and you're happy as a clam for you and your clients. Now, if these guys come in and they're, you know, they're the modern equivalent of Jay Gould, and go out and borrow like all the dough that they used to buy U.S. Steel, and now they're leveraged basically out the behind. Your bonds now could take a pretty serious hit, couldn't they?
Yep, absolutely. And again, that's why we do our homework and why we really try to get to know management and really try to understand management's vision. And yeah, the worst thing is a buyout where the company is looking to leverage their leverage. It's not the ideal situation for a bondholder, and actually definitely not the ideal situation if you own the equity either.
What would you do? You sit there and hope?
Yeah, the thing is, you kind of look at, you know, as a bond manager, and I don't think they have a double A rating or a single A rating, but as a bond manager, you would look at the company and you'd say, what's the worst case scenario? You do some kind of analysis, liquidation analysis, and what are the assets, and you want to see what would be the worst case. And if you can actually break down the value of the company and say, yeah, the enterprise value of this company is sufficient to cover the interest payments on these bonds, and the bonds are senior enough in the capital structure that they're going to get priority over some of the other outstanding debt. So that's the way you look at it from a bond person's point of view. Just because the company is not growing at a tremendous pace,
well, how do you,
doesn't mean they're not a good investment.
How do you figure out where in the pecking order of bonds, these U.S. steel bonds, if this thing goes through, how do they land in the Nippon bond structure?
Yeah, you actually have to do an analysis, and you have to do a review. You have to look at the capital structure. You have to look at all the debt that's outstanding. You got to find out where you are in the capital structure, where the bonds are that you purchased, because U.S. Steel has issued many bonds. So you can buy senior bonds, you can buy senior secured bonds, and then you've got to also correspondingly look at the bonds that have been issued by Nippon Steel, if that was the case, if they were the ones taken over. And then you want to find out exactly where you're going to stand in the capital structure. Something called being crammed down. So if part of the takeover involves bondholders being crammed down by the purchase, that would not be a good thing. Obviously, that would push the priority of your bonds to the bottom of the credit spectrum, and then you would be paid last if there was a liquidation or
do you always bankruptcy. last question, I promise, does U.S. Steel always become a full married part of Nippon, or can they keep it as a separate sub and the bonds are still part of the sub over here?
They could still keep it as a separate sub.
Wow.
I don't know what the specific terms of this buyout are, but they could absolutely keep it as a separate
entity. That could be a nightmare if they drain the funds out of this place, and the bonds could go under here, and Nippon could be fine.
More common than you think, Chief. That's
really,
that's,
wow.
Yeah, and that's the homework that's involved in looking at bonds when you're a bond manager.
Well, on that happy note.
Yeah.
Hey.
Well, there are people like me that know how to do that work. So. That's,
well, yeah. I mean, that's why I ask these questions, because we're not called upon to do that, and I would, you know, that would be a question I'd have to refer right out, because it's not.
Sure.
I mean, everybody's good at what they're good at, I guess. S&P futures down 5, NASDAQ futures down 60. What's your call, up or down today?
Flat and volatile.
Uh-oh. Greg?
Buy more.
Buy Mortimer. No, it was sell Mortimer. Sell, wasn't it? In the movie? Anyway, back tomorrow, Stocks and Jacks. S&P futures down 5, NASDAQ futures down 60.
That's all, folks.